revealed layers of solid stone under the topsoil. Sandwiched between the rock, there were thin layers of earth, some only a few inches thick. The tree was stunted from trying to grow in such ground, but the roots fought a stubborn fight. They ran over and under and about the rock in thin veins, thickening wherever they found a little life-giving soil between the rock strata.
"Look how that tree fights to live," Kitty said. "Look how it tries to dig its roots into rock."
Dr. Lieberman observed thoughtfully for a moment.
"That tree is the story of the Jews who have come back to Palestine," he said.
Ari stood in the high-ceilinged living room of Taha, the Mukhtar of Abu Yishah. The young Arab, his lifelong friend, nibbled on a piece of fruit from a large bowl and watched Ari begin pacing.
"There is enough double talk going on at the conferences in London," Ari said. "I think that you and I can talk straight."
Taha flipped the fruit down.
"How can I explain it, Ari? Pressure is being put on me. I have resisted it."
"Resisted it? Taha, you're talking to Ari Ben Canaan.
Times are changing.
Now wait a minute. Our people have lived together through two sets of riots. You went to school in Yadel. You lived in my home under the protection of my father."
"Yes, I existed because of your benevolence. Now you ask my village to exist the same way. You arm yourselves. Are we not allowed to arm ourselves? Or don't you trust us with guns as we have trusted you?"
"This isn't even you talking.
I hope that I never live to see the day that you and I must fight. But you know that passiveness is a thing of the past for all of us."
Ari spun around angrily.
"Taha, what has gotten into you? All right, then. Maybe you'd better hear it again. These stone houses in your village were designed and built by us. Your children can read and write because of us. You have sewers because of us. And your young don't die before the age of 6 because of us. We taught you how to farm properly and live decently. We have brought you things that your own people would not give you in 1,000 years. Your father knew this, and he was big enough to admit that no one hates or exploits an Arab worse than another Arab. He died because he knew your salvation was with the Jews, and he was man enough to stand for it."
Taha arose.
"And will you guarantee me that the Maccabees will not come in to Abu Yishah tonight and kill us?"
"Of course I can't guarantee it. But you know what the Maccabees stand for, just as you know what the Mufti stands for."
"I will never lift my hand against Yadel, Ari. You have my word."
Ari left, knowing that Taha meant what he said. But Taha was not the man of the strength that his father Kamal had been. Even as they promised peace to each other, a breach had come between Yadel and Abu Yishah. Just as breaches were coming to all the Arab and Jewish villages that had lived together in peace. Taha watched his friend leave the house and walk to the road near the stream and the mosque. He stood motionless long after Ari disappeared. Each day the pressure grew, and there were even voices of dissent in his own village. He was told that he was an Arab and a Muslim, and he had to choose his side. How could he turn on Ari and Barak Ben Canaan? Yet how could he still the voices around him? He was a brother of Ari. Or was he? This was the tormenting question. From childhood, his father had groomed him to lead his village. He knew the Jews had built the great cities and the roads and the schools, and they had redeemed the land, and they were the enlightened ones. Was he really their equal? Or was he a second-class citizen in his own land, riding on coattails, picking up the crumbs, living in the shadows of Jewish achievement? Yes, he had benefited from the Jews. His people had benefited more because his father had realized the Jews could give greater benefits than his own Arabs. Yet, was he a partner? Was his equality a real thing, or merely a phrase? Was he being tolerated rather than accepted? Was he really the brother of Ari Ben Canaan, or the poor cousin? Taha asked himself this question more often each day. Each time the answer was more certain. He was a brother in name only. What of this equality the Jews preached? Could he, as an Arab, ever declare that he had loved Yordana ben Canaan quietly and with the heartache that comes with long silence? He had loved her since he had lived under their roof, and she was but a child of 13. How far did their equality extend? Would they ever accept Taha and Yordana as man and wife? Would all the democracy-preaching members of the Moshav come to their wedding? What would happen then if Taha were to go to Yordana and tell her of his love? She would spit on him, of course. In his heart he felt an inferiority, and it tore him apart. Despite the fact that the distinction was far less than that between a land-owning effendi and the slave fellahin. He could not lift his hand against Ari, and he could never declare his love for Yordana. He could not fight his friends, nor could he resist the force around him which told him he was an Arab and an enemy of the Jew, and he had to fight them whether it was right or it was wrong. Chapter 4. Dr. Ernest Lieberman, the funny little hunchback, was able to translate his tremendous love of people into a living thing at Gandafna. The atmosphere was as casual as a summer camp. The children were given complete freedom of movement and thought. School classes were held outdoors, and the children dressed in shorts and lay about on the grass, so that even their academic study was close to nature. Dr. Lieberman's children had come from the stink pits of the earth, the ghetto, and the concentration camp. Yet there was never a serious disciplinary problem at Gandafna. Disobedience did not exist. Thievery was unheard of, and promiscuity between sexes was rare. Gandafna was life itself to the children, and they governed and policed themselves with a pride and dignity that reflected their reaction to being loved. The range of learning and thinking was vast at Gandafna. It was difficult to believe the participants were merely teenagers. The library ran from St. Thomas Aquinas to Freud. No book was barred, no subject seemed too broad. The children possessed a political awareness beyond their years. The primary principle the staff and faculty was able to inculcate upon these children was that their lives had a purpose. Gandafna had an international staff with teachers from 22 countries, ranging from Iranians to the rugged kibbutz-bred Sabras. Kitty was the only Gentile as well as the only American, and this proved to be a paradox. She was looked upon with both reserve and affection. Her early fears of hostility proved unfounded. There was an air of intellectualism which seemed to make Gandafna more like a university than an orphanage. Kitty was welcomed as a part of a team whose prime concern was the welfare of the children. She became very friendly with many of the staff and was completely at ease in their company. The problem of the Jewishness of the village also proved smaller than she had expected. Judaism at Gandafna was founded upon a fierce kind of nationalism rather than upon any religious basis. There was no formal religious training or even a synagogue. They managed to keep tension and fear out of Gandafna, despite reports of growing violence all over Palestine. The village was physically isolated enough to form some shelter from the realities of the bloodshed. Yet it was not completely free of the signs of danger. The border was above them. Fort Esther was always in sight. Trenches, shelters, arms, and military training were in evidence. The medical department building was in the administration area on the edge of the center green. The building had a clinic and a well-equipped 20-bed hospital and operating room. The doctor was shared with the Yad El Moshav and came daily. There was a dentist and four trainee nurses under Kitty and a full-time psychiatrist. Kitty ran her clinic and hospital with machine-like efficiency after completely overhauling the system. She put sick calls and hospital rounds and the dispensation of treatment on a rigid schedule. She demanded and received a respect for her position that created a ripple of talk in the village. She kept a discreet professional distance from her assistants, and she refused to operate her section with the informality of the rest of the village. She discouraged the familiarity which most of the teachers encouraged. This was all strange to Gandalfna. There was a reluctant admiration of her, for the medical section was the most efficient department the village had. In their desire to foster freedom, the Jews often leaned too far back from the discipline that Kitty Fremont knew. She was not disliked for the way she ran her department. When Kitty took off her uniform, she was the most sought-after companion in Gandalfna. If she was firm in running her section, she was the opposite when it came to her children. The 50 Exodus youngsters at Gandalfna continued to keep their identification, and Kitty Fremont was always to be identified with them. She was Mother of the Exodus. It seemed a natural step that she become personally involved in the cases of some of the more disturbed children from the Exodus. She volunteered to work with the psychiatrist in psychotherapy. With the disturbed children, Kitty completely dropped her coldness and gave to them all the warmth she was capable of giving. Gandalfna and Palestine had tremendous curative powers, but the horrors of the past still brought on the nightmares, the insecurity, and the hostility that required patience and skill and love. Once a week, Kitty went down to Abu Yeshah with the doctor to hold morning clinic for the Arabs. How pathetic the dirty little Arab children were beside the robust youngsters of Gandalfna. How futile their lives seemed in contrast to the spirit of the Youth Aliyah village. There seemed to be no laughter or songs or games or purpose among the Arab children. It was a static existence, a new generation born on an eternal caravan in an endless desert. Her stomach turned over as she entered the one-room hovels shared with chickens, dogs, and donkeys, 8 or 10 people on the same earth floor. Yet Kitty could not dislike these people. They were heartwarming and gracious beyond their capacity. They, too, longed for better things. She became friendly with Taha, the young Mukhtar, who was always present on clinic days. Many times Kitty felt that Taha wanted to speak to her about things other than the health problem of the village. She felt an urgency about him. But Taha was an Arab. A woman could only be confided in on certain matters, and he never revealed his constant fears to her. The days passed into the late winter of 1947. Karen and Kitty had grown inseparably close. The young girl, who had found some measure of happiness in the most abysmal places, fairly bloomed at Gandalfna. She had become overnight one of the most popular children in the village. Karen became more dependent on Kitty's guidance through the complex stages of early maturity. Kitty was aware that each day at Gandalfna would tend to draw Karen farther away from America. She kept America alive in the girl's interest while the search for Karen's father continued. Dov Landau was a problem. Several times Kitty was tempted to step in between the boy and Karen. Their relationship seemed to be deepening. But Kitty, recognizing the possibility of driving them closer together, stayed out of it. Karen's devotion to the boy perplexed her, for Dov gave nothing in return. He was morose and withdrawn. He did talk a little more, but for practical purposes, Karen was still the only one who could reach him. Dov became obsessed with a desire to learn. His education had been almost nothing, and now he seemed to want to try to make up for it with a passion. He was excused from both Gadna military training and agriculture. Dov crammed as much into himself as he could absorb. He read and studied day and night. He concentrated upon his natural gift of art with studies of anatomy and drawing and architecture and blueprinting. Occasionally, a painting would furnish an escape valve, and his drive would come out in effects that displayed his talent and energy. Sometimes he came near breaking through and joining into Gandalfna society, only to withdraw again. He lived by himself, he engaged in no activities, and he saw only Karen outside classes. Kitty took the problem to Dr. Lieberman. He had seen many boys and girls like Dov Landau. Dr. Lieberman had observed that Dove was an alert and intelligent human being who showed great talent. He felt any attempts to force attention on him would work the opposite way. So long as the boy remained harmless and grew no worse, he should be left alone. As the weeks passed, Kitty was disappointed that she did not hear from or see Ari. The statue of Daphna and the Yad El Moshav below always seemed to remind her. From time to time, when she had occasion to pass Yad El, she dropped in on Sarah Ben Canaan, until the two women became quite friendly. Yordana learned of it and made no effort to disguise her dislike for Kitty. The beautiful young red-headed hellion made it a point to be rude whenever she spoke to Kitty. One evening, Kitty came to her cottage to find Yordana standing before the mirror, holding one of her cocktail dresses in front of her. Kitty's sudden appearance did not bother Yordana.
"It is pretty, if you like this sort of thing,"
Yordana said, hanging the dress back in the closet. Kitty walked to the stove and put on some water for tea.
"To what do I owe the honor of this call?"
Yordana continued to look about Kitty's cottage at the little touches of her femininity.
"There are some Palmach troops training at the Ein Ohr kibbutz."
"I've heard something about it," Kitty said.
"We have a shortage of instructors. We have a shortage of everything, anyhow. I was asked to ask you if you would come to Ein Ohr once a week to give a course in first aid and field sanitation."
Kitty pulled back the drapes and kicked off her shoes and settled back on the studio bed.
"I would prefer not to do anything that would bring me into contact with troops."
"Why not?" Yordana pressed.
"Well, I suppose there is no graceful way of refusing you, and I would like it better if the Palmach understood why."
"What's to understand?"
"My personal feelings. I don't wish to become involved."
Yordana laughed coldly.
"I told them at Ein Ohr it would be a waste of time to speak to you."
"Is it impossible for you to respect my feelings?"
"Mrs. Fremont, you can work anywhere in the world and remain neutral. This is a strange place for you to come to work if you want to stay out of trouble. Why are you really here?"
Kitty sprang off the bed angrily.
"None of your damn business."
The tea kettle whistled. Kitty snapped it off.
"I know why you are here. You want Ari. You're an insolent young lady, and I think I've taken just about all I'm going to from you."
Yordana remained unmoved.
"I've seen the way you looked at him. If I wanted Ari, you would be the last thing in my way. Tell yourself you don't want him, but don't tell it to me. You are not Ari's kind of woman. You don't care for us."
Kitty turned and lit a cigarette. Yordana came behind her.
"Daphna was Ari's kind of woman. She understood him. No American woman ever will."
Kitty turned around.
"Because I don't run around in shorts and hike up the sides of mountains and shoot cannons and sleep in ditches doesn't make me 1 ounce less a woman than you. You or that precious statue. I know what's the matter with you. You're afraid of me."
"That's funny.
Don't tell me what makes a woman. You don't know. You aren't one. You're Tarzan's mate and you behave as though you belong in a jungle. A brush and comb wouldn't be a bad start at fixing what's wrong with you."
Kitty pushed past Yordana and threw open her closet.
"Take a good look. This is what women wear."
Tears of anger welled in Yordana's eyes.
"The next time you wish to see me, you may come to my office," Kitty said coldly. "I am not a kibbutznik, and I like my privacy."
Yordana slammed the door so hard it shook the cottage. Karen came to Kitty's office after the dinner sick call and flopped into a chair.
"Hi," Kitty said. "How did it go today?"
Karen grabbed two imaginary cow teats and made a milking motion.
"Weak hands. I'm a lousy milker," she opined with teenage sadness. "Kitty, I am truly broken-hearted. I must talk to you."
"Shoot."
"Not now. We have a gardener meeting. We are cleaning some new Hungarian rifles. What a mess."
"The Hungarian rifles can wait a few minutes. What is troubling you, dear?"
"Yona, my roommate, just when we are getting to be intimate friends. She's going to join the Palmach next week."
Kitty felt a stab of dismay. How much longer until Karen came to her and told her she was going to do the same thing?
Kitty shoved her papers aside.
You know, Karen, I have been thinking that there is a real shortage of good nurses and medical aides. I mean, in the Palmach as well as in the settlements. You've had lots of experience working with the youngsters in the DP camps, and I've taken on quite a crowd of the disturbed ones. Do you suppose it would make sense if I asked Dr. Lieberman to let you come to work with me and let me train you as my assistant?
Would it?
Karen broke into a broad grin. Fine. I'll try to arrange it so you skip the agriculture work and report right to my office after school.
Karen sobered.
Well, I don't know. It doesn't seem quite fair to the others.
As we say in American, they won't be losing a farmer, they'll be gaining a nurse.
Kitty, I have a terrible confession to make. Don't tell the Youth Aliyah, the Zion Settlement Society, or the Central Kibbutz Movement, but honest, I'm the worst farmer at Gandafna, and I'd just love to be a nurse.
Kitty got up and walked to Karen and put her arm about the girl's shoulder.
Do you suppose that with Yona gone you would like to move into my cottage and live with me?
The instantaneous look of happiness on Karen's face was all the answer that Kitty needed. Kitty left Dr. Lieberman's cottage early to give Karen the good news. Dr. Lieberman had considered their duty to dispense love and not rules, and decided the cause would not be hurt with one less farmer and one more nurse. When she left Karen, she crossed the center green and stopped before the statue of Daphne. She felt that she had hurt Daphne tonight. She had won a victory. With Karen near her, she could keep the child from becoming an aggressive, angry Sabra girl. It was good to live with a purpose, Kitty knew, but too much purpose could destroy womanliness. She had hit Jordana in a weak spot, and she knew it. Since birth, Jordana had been given a mission to carry out without question, at the price of her own personal happiness, career, and femininity. Jordana did not know how to compete with the elegant women coming into Palestine from the continent and from America. She hated Kitty because she wanted to be more like Kitty, and Kitty knew it.
Kitty, a voice called out in the darkness.
Yes?
I hope I didn't startle you.
It was Ari. As he came near her, she felt that same now familiar sensation of helplessness.
I'm sorry I haven't been able to get up to see you. Jordana gave you my messages?
Jordana? Yes, of course,
Kitty lied. How are you getting along?
Fine.
I came up to ask you if you would care to take the day off tomorrow. A Palmach group is going to climb Mount Tabor. It is something that should not be missed. Would you come with me?
Yes, I'd love to.
Chapter 5 Ari and Kitty arrived at the kibbutz of Beit Alonim, the House of the Oaks, at the foot of Mount Tabor, shortly after dawn. It was the kibbutz which gave birth to the Palmach during the war, and the place Ari had trained troops. Tabor was odd, not high enough to be a real mountain, but far too high to be a hill. It stood in the middle of flatlands, arising suddenly in the shape of a thumb poking through the earth. After breakfast at the kibbutz, Ari rolled a pair of packs with rations, canteen, and blankets, and drew a Sten gun from the arsenal. He planned to hike up ahead of the rest of the group during the morning hours when it was cool. The air was crisp and invigorating, and Kitty was charged with the spirit of adventure. They passed through the Arab village of Deburia, at the opposite base of Tabor from Beit Alonim, and took up a narrow dirt path. Within moments they could see Nazareth in the hills several kilometers away. It stayed cool and their progress was fast, although Kitty realized her first view was deceptive. Tabor rose to more than 2,000 feet. It was going to be a long day. Deburia grew smaller and began to look quaint as they put distance between themselves and the village. Suddenly, Ari stopped and tensed.
What is it?
Goats. Can you smell them?
Kitty sniffed.
No, I don't smell anything.
Ari's eyes narrowed. He scanned the path ahead.
It circled out of sight, and there was a very gentle slope off to the blind side.
Probably Bedouins. There was a report about them at the kibbutz. They must have moved in since yesterday. Come on.
Around the turn, they saw a dozen haired goatskin tents along the hillside and a flock of little black goats grazing around them. Two rifle-bearing nomads came up to them. Ari spoke to them in Arabic, then followed them to the largest of the tents, which obviously belonged to the sheikh. Kitty looked around. They seemed the dregs of humanity. The women were encased in black robes and layers of dirt. She was not able to smell the goats, but she was able to smell the women. Chains of Ottoman coins formed veils over their faces. The children wore dirty rags. A grizzled individual emerged from the tent and exchanged greetings with Ari. They conversed a moment. Then Ari whispered to Kitty,
"We must go in, or he will be insulted. Be a good girl and eat whatever he offers you. You can throw it up later."
The inside of the tent stank even more. They sat down on goat hair and sheep wool rugs and exchanged amenities. The sheikh was impressed that Kitty came from America and relayed the information that he once owned a photograph of Mrs. Roosevelt. Courses of food came. A greasy lamb leg was thrust into Kitty's hand, together with marrow mixed with rice. Kitty nibbled. The sheikh watched expectantly. She smiled weakly and nodded to convey how delicious it was. Unwashed fruits were served, and the meal was ended with thick, sickeningly sweet coffee in cups so filthy they were crusted. The diners wiped hands on trousers and mouths with sleeves, and after a bit more conversation, Ari begged leave. They left the camp behind. Kitty emitted a long and loud sigh.
"I feel sorry for them," she said.
"Please don't. They are quite sure they are the freest men on earth. Didn't you ever see the Desert Song when you were a girl?"
"Yes, but now I know the composer never saw a Bedouin camp. What were you two men gabbing about?"
"I told him to behave tonight and not try to collect any rings and watches from the Palmach."
"And what else?"
"He wanted to buy you. He offered me 6 camels.
"Why, that old devil. What did you tell him?"
"I told him that anyone could see you were a 10-camel girl."
Ari glanced at the rising sun.
"It's going to get hot from now on. We'd better get out of these heavy clothes and pack them."
Kitty wore a pair of the traditional blue shorts from the Gandafna stores.
"Damn, you look just like a Sabra."
They followed the trail, which wove along the southern face of Tabor. Both of them perspired as the sun beat down. The trail broke in frequent places, and they were forced to climb. Ari's strong hands led Kitty up the steep inclines. By late afternoon, they had passed the 2,000-foot mark. The entire top of Tabor was a large, rounded plateau. The south edge of the plateau opened the entire Yezreel Valley to their eyes. It was a staggering sight. Kitty could follow the Yezreel, the square-cut fields, the splashes of green around the Jewish settlements, and the white clusters of Arab villages all the way to Mount Carmel and the Mediterranean. In the other direction was the Sea of Galilee, so that the entire width of Palestine was below them. Through field glasses, Kitty followed Ari's pointing out Ein Dor, where Saul met the witch, and the bald top of Mount Gilboa, where Gideon was buried, and Saul and Jonathan fell in battle to the Philistines.
"Ye mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew, neither let there be rain upon you nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty is vilely cast away, the shield of Saul."
Kitty lowered the glasses.
"Why, Ari, you are poetic."
"It is the altitude. Everything is so removed from up here. Look over there. Beit She'an Valley. Beit She'an Tel holds the oldest civilized city in the world. David knows more about these than I do. There are hundreds of tells around Palestine. He says that if we were to start excavating them now, our modern cities would be ruins by the time we are finished. You see, Palestine is the bridge of history here, and you are standing on the center of the bridge.
Tabor has been a battleground since men made axes out of stone. The Hebrews stood against the Romans here, and between the Crusaders and the Arabs it changed hands 50 times. Deborah hid here with her army and swooped down on the Canaanites. The battleground of the ages. You know what we say? That Moses should have walked the tribes for another 40 years and found a decent place. They walked over the plateau through a pine forest with relics of Roman, Byzantine, Crusader, and Arab all around. Mosaics, pottery, a wall here, a stone there. 2 abbeys, one Greek Orthodox and one Roman Catholic, stood near the grounds believed to be the place Christ was transfigured and spoke to Moses and Elijah. Beyond the forest, they reached the highest point of Tabor. Ruins of a Crusader fort and Saracen castle occupied the site. They picked their way over the rubble and the walls until they had climbed the eastern rampart, which hung over the mountainside and was called Wall of the East Winds. Here the Sea of Galilee came into full view with the horns of Hattin, where Saladin the Kurd demolished Crusader forces. The wind blew through Kitty's hair as she stood on the wall, and the air began to cool again. They sat for over an hour with Ari pointing out the countless points of biblical history. Finally, they retreated to that point on the edge of the forest where it met the castles, and changed back to their warmer clothing. Ari spread their blankets, and Kitty stretched out and grunted with a weary happiness.
It has been a wonderful day, Ari. But I am going to ache for a week.
Ari propped himself up on an elbow, watched her. Again he felt a desire for her, but he held his silence. By dusk, parties of 3s and 4s and 5s began reaching the summit. There were dark and olive-skinned Orientals and Africans, and there were blondes who had immigrated to Israel. There were many girls, most of them straight and high-breasted. There were the Sabras, with their large mustaches and the stamp of aggressiveness. It was a reunion. Palmach groups had to train in small units in different kibbutzim to remain hidden. This was a chance for both friends from the city and from the same settlements to see each other again, and for sweethearts to meet. The greetings were warm, with affectionate hugs and backslaps and kisses. They were a lively bunch of youngsters in their late teens and early 20s. Yoav Yarkoni and Zev Gilboa had come when they learned Kitty would be there, and she was delighted. David and Jordana came also, and Jordana was provoked by David's attention to Kitty, but she remained quiet to avoid creating a scene. By dusk, nearly 200 of the young Palmach soldiers had gathered. A pit was dug near the castle wall, while some of them turned to gathering wood for an all-night fire. 3 lambs were prepared and spitted for roasting. The sun plunged down behind the Israel Valley. The fire was lit with a single bursting blaze, and the lambs were placed over their pits, and couples joined in a huge circle around the fire. Kitty, the visiting dignitary, was forced into the place of honor with Yoav, Zev, and Ari around her. Soon the plateau atop Mount Tabor rang with songs. They were the same songs that Kitty had heard the children sing at Gandafna. They told of the wonder of the water sprinklers that redeemed the land, and they told of the beauty of the Galilee and Judea. They sang of how haunted and lovely was the Negev desert, and they sang the spirited marches of the old guardsmen and the Haganah and the Palmach. They sang a song that said that David the king still walked the land of Israel. Yoav sat cross-legged with his tambour before him. It was a clay drum with goatskin head. With his fingertips and the heels of his hand, he beat a rhythm to a reed flute, playing an ancient Hebraic melody. Several of the Oriental girls danced in the same slow, swaying, sensuous gyrations that must have been danced in the Palace of Solomon. With each new song and each new dance, the party quickened.
Jordana! Someone called. We want Jordana!
She got into the ring and a cheer went up. An accordion played a Hungarian folk tune, and everyone clapped in beat, and Jordana whirled around the edge of the ring, pulling out partners for a wild chardash. One by one, she danced her partners down, with her red hair flying wildly in her face, framed against the leaping fire. Faster the accordion played, and faster the onlookers clapped, until Jordana herself stopped in exhaustion. A half dozen came to the center and started a hora, the dance of the Jewish peasants. The hora ring grew larger and larger until everyone was up and a second ring formed outside the first. Yoav and Ari pulled Kitty into the circle. The circle moved in one direction, then stopped as the dancers made a sudden leap and changed directions. They had been singing and dancing for 4 hours, and there was no indication of slowing up. David and Jordana slipped away quietly to the Saracen castle and wandered through the rooms until the sounds of the music and the tambour nearly vanished. They came upon a tiny cell set in the wall of the east winds, and now the sound of the wind from the Israel Valley was all that they could hear. David spread his blanket on the earth, and they embraced and caressed and loved each other.
"David, David," Jordana cried, "I love you so."
The wind died, and they could hear wild music.
"David, David, David,"
she whispered over and over as her lips pressed his neck. And David repeated her name over and over. His hand felt for the smoothness of her body. She took the clothing from her to ease his way, and they pressed against each other, and she asked to be taken, and they blended into one. After their love, Jordana lay in his arms. His fingertips traced over her lips and her eyes and through her hair.
"Jordana,"
his whisper thrilled her through her body and soul.
"Do you remember the first time, David?"
"Yes. I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys," she whispered. "For lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth. The time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land."
It became so still that each could hear only the other's uneven breathing and the other's heart beating.
"Take us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. My beloved is mine, and I am his. Oh, David, tell me. Tell me."
David whispered with his lips touching her ear.
"Behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair. Thou hast dove's eyes within thy locks. Thy lips are like a thread of scarlet."
She squeezed his hand that rested upon her breast, and he kissed her breast.
"Thy two breasts are like two young roes that are twins, which feed among the lilies."
And he kissed her lips.
"And the roof of thy mouth, like the best wine for my beloved, that goeth down sweetly, causing the lips of those who are asleep to speak."
David and Jordana fell into a bliss-filled sleep, locked tightly in each other's arms. At 4 o'clock in the morning, the lamb was served with hot Arabic coffee. Kitty was honored with the first cut. The fervor of song and dance had slowed a little. Many of the couples lay in each other's arms. The lamb tasted wonderful. Yoav played his tambour, and the reed flute behind him made a tune as ancient as the land itself. One of the girls, who had been born in distant Yemen, sang in a voice filled with the mystic and melancholy of the Hebrew, right from the pages of the Bible. Her haunting voice sang a psalm of David. Kitty Fremont looked at the faces in the dying firelight. What kind of army was this? What kind of army without uniform or rank? What kind of army where the women fought alongside their men with rifle and bayonet? Who were these young lions of Judea? She looked at the face of Ari ben Canaan, and a chill passed through her body. An electrifying revelation hit her. This was no army of mortals. These were the ancient Hebrews. These were the faces of Dan and Reuben and Judah and Ephraim. These were Samson's and Deborah's and Yoav's and Saul's. It was the army of Israel, and no force on earth could stop them, for the power of God was within them. Chapter 6. Chatham House, Institute of International Relations, London. Cecil Bradshaw, the dumpy expert on the Middle East, had been studying the survey reports from a variety of sources. For 3 days, he had been digesting the summaries. The Colonial Office, the Ministry, and even Number 10 Downing Street were all bringing pressure on him. The Palestine Mandate was in a muddle. A clean-cut, new policy had to be formulated. Bradshaw was a man of 37 years' experience in the area. During that time, he had gone through 100 conferences with the Zionists and the Arabs. Bradshaw believed, as most of the officialdom believed, that Britain's interests lay with the Arabs. Time and again, he was able to cover up Arab blackmail and threats. This time, they had gone completely wild. The current London conferences were ending in a fiasco. It is completely obvious that Haj Amin el-Husseini, the Mufti, is running the Palestine Higher Arab Committee from exile in Cairo. Our failure to prosecute the Mufti as a war criminal for fear of religious outbursts has now come back to haunt us. The Arab attitude has reached complete unreason. They refuse to sit at the same table with the Jews unless pre-imposed conditions are agreed upon. Cecil Bradshaw had been at the San Remo conference when the Middle East was divided between the British and the French, and he had been there when the Articles of Mandate were drawn and when the Balfour Declaration was issued. Bradshaw worked on Churchill's group that took half the Palestine Mandate and created the Kingdom of Transjordan. In all the years, in all the Mufti's riots, they had never been up against a band of fighters in the class of the Maccabees. The Jewish terrorists fought with a fearsome conviction. We have time and again demanded from the Yishuv Central and the Jewish community that they assist British authorities in stamping out the gangster elements who go under the name of the Maccabees. Whereas the Yishuv claims no authority over these people and they publicly condemn their actions, it is known that a large segment of the Jews secretly approve the gangster actions. We have received no cooperation in this matter. Maccabee activities have reached such proportion that we deem it necessary to evacuate all non-essential British personnel and families from Palestine. Bradshaw read over the reports of the stepped-up terrorist raids which rocked the Holy Land from one end to another. In addition to the costly gangster raids on the Haifa refinery, which stopped production for 2 weeks, and the raid on the Lida airdrome, which destroyed a squadron of fighter planes, 10 major road ambushes and 15 major raids on British installations have taken place. There is increasing evidence that the Haganah and its striking arm, the Palmach, is becoming restless and may even be partaking in some of the recent raids. The leaky tubs, the floating slums of Aliyah Bet, brought loads of illegal immigrants into the shores of Palestine. Despite increased naval patrol forces, there has been a marked step-up in Aliyah Bet activity since the Exodus incident. The America, San Miguel, Ulloa, Abril, Susanna, and San Filippo have carried 8,000 illegals from European displaced persons camps. We have reason to believe 2 other ships were successful in breaking the blockade and beached. Our embassies and consulates in the Mediterranean countries report that at least 5 more ships are being outfitted by Aliyah Bet to attempt immigrant runs on Palestine in the near future. The British command had powerful forces in Palestine. 52 vaunted Taggart forts spread an interlocking network over the tiny country. In addition, there were border forts, such as Fort Esther, and there was a regular police force in every town, and there was the powerful Arab Legion from Transjordan. Besides the Taggarts, the British maintained large bases at Atlit in the Haifa area, the Schneller Barracks in Jerusalem, and the immense Sarafand camp outside Tel Aviv. We have in recent months launched Operations Noah, Ark, Lobster, Mackerel, Cautious, Lonesome, Octopus, Cantonment, and Harp to keep constant pressure upon the Yishuv. These operations basically are for continued screening for illegals, cordons, and arms searches, and counterattacks where our forces have been attacked. Our success has been limited due to the 100% organization and cooperation of every Jew in the Yeshuv in their efforts. Arms are hidden in flower boxes, file cabinets, stoves, refrigerators, false table legs, and 1,000 other ingenious places, making arms seizure a near impossibility. Arms are transported by women and small children who readily engage in this practice. Our efforts to obtain Jewish informers has met with total failure. On the other hand, the Jews are able not only to purchase Arab spies, but are getting information from sympathetic people within the British command. The Jews are manufacturing weapons of improvised nature, and the Sten guns, landmines, and grenades are continually improving in quality and ingenuity. In a recent attempt to uncover a manufacturing plant on a kibbutz, the women poured scalding water on our soldiers. Bradshaw was not only having his trouble in controlling the mandate. Other outside factors were increasing the pressure. In England, the people were living under the hardships of austerity, and the economy was failing badly. The cost of maintaining the Palestine garrison was enormous. The English were sick of the bloodshed, too. On the world political scene, the American Zionists had definitely caught the ear of Truman and had in him a sympathetic ally. Since our failure to follow the recommendation of the Anglo-American Committee to allow 100,000 Jews to enter Palestine, our prestige has fallen greatly among our allies. Also damaging our prestige is the manner of humiliation by the Maccabee terrorist operation. British authority has never been so badly flaunted as in the recent kidnapping of a British judge who passed sentence on a Jewish terrorist. Cecil Bradshaw took off his horn-rimmed glasses, wiped his red eyes, and shook his head. What a mess. He thumbed through the reports once more. Jamal Husseini, the Mufti's nephew, was again wiping out Arab opposition within Palestine through assassination. The Haganah, through Aliyah Bet, and the Maccabees, under Akiva, had made things impossible. British officers had been horsewhipped in public streets, and British soldiers were hung in reprisals. The Jews who had preached and obeyed the rules of self-restraint during the two sets of pre-war riots were showing less and less restraint against the Arab acts of aggression. It was said in official circles that Cecil Bradshaw had lost his stomach for fighting the Jews after the Exodus incident. The Palestine Mandate was nearing its 12th hour. The little country occupied a position of tremendous economic and strategic importance. It was the pivot of the empire itself. The Haifa naval base and refinery, and the position in relation to the central artery of the Suez, made it imperative that it be held. The intercom buzzer went off on Bradshaw's desk. General Tevor Brown has arrived. Bradshaw and Tevor Brown mumbled cold greetings. Tevor Brown was one of the few pro-Jews in official circles. It was he who had predicted the end of the mandate in this very office at the onset of the Exodus incident, and had pleaded that the Exodus be allowed to sail before the hunger strike. Tevor Brown had always felt that the Jews and not the Arabs deserved British support for the reason that the Jews were faithful allies and could be depended upon, and the Arabs could not. He had been for the building of a Jewish Commonwealth nation out of Palestine. General Tevor Brown's thinking could not sway Bradshaw and the Chatham House crowd or the Colonial Office. Even at this hour, they did not have the courage to reverse their drastic mistake, but were standing ready to sink with it. The fear of Arab blackmail over the oil fields and the Suez Canal prevailed. "I have been reading the summaries," Bradshaw said. Tevor Brown lit a cigar. "Yes, very interesting. The Jews certainly aren't obliging us by marching backwards into the sea." Bradshaw tapped his pudgy fingers on the desktop, resenting the general's I-told-you-so attitude. "I must give a recommendation in a few weeks. I don't want your needling implications, Sir Clarence. I wanted to speak over the advisability of retaining Havenhurst. I think the time has come to get tougher with the Jews." "Havenhurst is fine for what you want, unless you wish to obtain the services of some SS generals in the war crimes prisons. We still maintain a civil government in Palestine, you know. We do have a high commissioner. Bradshaw turned crimson under the insults. He managed to hold his temper, a temper which was growing shorter and more violent each day.
I think the time has come to place greater authority with Havenhurst.
He handed a sheet of paper over the desk to Tevor Brown. It was a letter addressed to the British commander in Palestine, General Sir Arnold Havenhurst, KBE, CB, DSO, MC.
The situation has degenerated to such a state that unless means can be recommended for immediate stabilization by you, I will be compelled to suggest the matter be turned over to the United Nations.
Well said, Bradshaw, Tevor Brown said. I'm certain Havenhurst will have some rather interesting suggestions, if you are a devotee of horror stories. Swat, Palestine. The retirement order came through for Brigadier Bruce Sutherland quickly and quietly after the Exodus affair. He moved to Palestine and settled down on Mount Canaan, near Swat, the ancient city at the entrance to the Hula Valley in northern Galilee. At long last, Bruce Sutherland seemed to find a bit of peace and some respite from the years of torment since the death of his mother. For the first time, he was able to sleep at night without fear. Sutherland purchased a magnificent small villa on Mount Canaan, 3 miles from Swat proper. The air was the purest in Palestine, and a constant fresh breeze kept summer's heat from fully penetrating the area. His home was of white plaster with red-tiled roof and granite floor. It was open and breezy and tastefully furnished in Mediterranean decor. Beyond his rear patio there was a terraced hillside of 4 full dunams of land, which he converted into a lush garden crowned with 400 Galilee rose bushes. The rear garden afforded a breathtaking view of Swat across the valley. From here the city appeared to be a perfect cone in shape. At the wide base of Swat's hill were the beginnings of winding roads which fought up the peak to the Acropolis on top, some 3,000 feet in the air. Like so many of the hilltops in Palestine, the Acropolis of Swat had once been a citadel in the revolutions of the Hebrews against the Greeks and Romans. He spent his days puttering in his rose garden, considered to be the finest in Palestine, on trips to the holy places, in studying Hebrew and Arabic, or in just wandering through the maze of crooked and aimless alleys that made up Swat. The town was a constant fascination. It was pressed against the hillside with its narrow oriental streets circling up toward the Acropolis in no fixed plan, and the houses were jammed together equally haphazardly. These, each with its own special design, grillwork, odd-shaped windows, doors, and balconies, cluttered the strangled passageways to add up to a strange sort of charm. The Jewish quarter, a tenth of the city, was inhabited by the poverty-stricken pious who were content to live off the meager offerings of co-religionists. Swat was the center of the Kabbalah, the Jewish science of mysticism. The ancient ones here spent their lives in study and prayer and were as colorful as the town itself. They ambled along the rows of tiny shops dressed in outlandish oriental costumes and tattered remains of once majestic silks. They were a gentle and peaceful lot, and for this reason the Kabbalists of Swat had suffered the most at the hands of the Mufti's riots, for they were least able to defend themselves. Their history in Palestine was one of the longest unbroken records of Jewish habitation of the Holy Land. The Crusaders banished the Jews, but after their defeat, the Kabbalists returned to Swat and had remained ever since. The cemetery held graves of the great Kabbalist scholars with tombs dating back 400 and 500 years. The Kabbalists all believed that anyone buried in Swat would go straight to Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden. So pure was the air in Swat. Sutherland never tired of walking through the tortuous lanes crowded with tiny synagogues and watching the people or filling himself with the folklore and legend of the rabbis and of the Kabbalah itself. The Arab section of Swat held the usual broken-down hovels that are found in every Arab city and town in the world. However, The wonderful climate and scenic beauty of Sfat attracted many Effendi families to build splendid and spacious homes. Mount Canaan had many homes and resorts for the Jews. Arab Sfat had the same for wealthy Arabs. Sutherland had friends in both places. Consistent with the Arab renown for building atop ruins, there were, in the Arab quarters of Sfat, remains of medieval buildings converted into contemporary housing. The most beautiful example of the architecture was the Mosque of the Daughters of Jacob on the ruins of a Hungarian Crusader convent. The crown jewel of Sfat was the Acropolis. The paths that wound up to the hilltop passed the old Knights Templar castle and the ruins of a Hebrew fort. The very peak stood in a pine forest amid a carpet of wildflowers and commanded a view from the Sea of Galilee on the south to the Hula Lake in the north, where one could follow the winding course of the Jordan River. On the horizon was Mount Hermon, and all the valleys and hills of the Galilee were visible beyond Meron on the western side. On this hill, the ancient Hebrews came once each year to light a fire. The signal would be seen and transmitted from hill to hill to indicate the start of the holy days. In the days before calendars, the holy days were determined by calculations of the chief rabbis, and the fires burned on the hilltops from Jerusalem to Tabor to Gilboa to Sfat and on to Babylon to where the Jews lived in captivity. One discordant note jarred the otherwise perfect beauty and visual poetry. A large, ugly, concrete taggart fort stood outside Sfat on the road up Mount Canaan and was visible from Sutherland's villa. Sutherland ventured north to look at the Tell of Hazor and along the Lebanese border to see the burial places of Esther at the fort and Joshua at Abu Yishah. It was by chance that he happened into Gan Dafna and friendship with Dr. Lieberman and Kitty Fremont. For Kitty and Sutherland, the renewal of the brief acquaintance made at Cyprus was a welcoming thing. Sutherland was happy to develop into a patron saint of the children. Kitty prevailed upon him to let some of the more disturbed children come with her to visit his villa and Sfat. In a short time, the two formed a fast friendship. One afternoon, Sutherland returned from Gan Dafna and was surprised to find his former aide, Major Fred Caldwell, awaiting him.
"How long have you been in Palestine, Freddy?"
"I arrived just a bit ago."
"Where are you serving?"
"Headquarters, Jerusalem, in intelligence. I'm doing liaison with the Criminal Investigation Division. They've had a shake-up recently. Seems that some of our chaps have been working with the Haganah and even with the Maccabees, if you can imagine that."
Sutherland could imagine it quite easily.
"Actually, sir, this visit is only partly social, although I certainly intended to drop up and see how you've been getting on. General Havenhurst asked me to see you personally because I had worked under you in the past."
"Oh?"
"As you know, we are now in the process of carrying out Operation Polly, the evacuation of non-essential British from Palestine."
"I've heard it referred to as Operation Folly," Sutherland said.
Freddy smiled politely at the jibe and cleared his throat.
"General Havenhurst wanted to know what you planned to do."
"I don't plan to do a thing. This is my home, and this is where I am going to remain."
Freddy's fingers drummed impatiently on the tabletop.
"What I mean, sir, is that General Havenhurst wants it understood that once the non-essentials are gone, he cannot assume responsibility for your safety. If you remain here, it could pose a problem to us."
Caldwell's speech held obvious, devious connotations. Havenhurst knew of Sutherland's leanings and was afraid of his working with the Haganah. He was, in effect, advising him to get out.
"Tell General Havenhurst I am grateful for his concern, and I fully realize his exact position."
Freddy wanted to press the matter. Sutherland arose quickly and thanked Caldwell for the visit and walked him to the driveway, where a sergeant waited with a staff car. He watched the car drive down toward the Taggart Fort. As usual, Freddy had botched his assignment. His delivery of Havenhurst's warning had been clumsy indeed. Sutherland walked back to the villa and thought it over. He was in physical danger. The Maccabees could easily take exception to a retired British brigadier with Arab friends living alone on Mount Canaan, although the Maccabees would certainly think twice about doing him in. There was no danger from the Haganah. He had a loose contact with them, and they were not only discriminate, but did not go in for assassination. On the other side, there was no telling what Husseini was likely to do. Sutherland had friends among the Jews. Some of them could well have been Maccabees, unbeknownst to him. Bruce Sutherland walked to his gardens. They were bursting with the early spring roses. He looked beyond the valley to Sfat. He had found peace and comfort here. The hideous dreams were gone. No, he would not leave tomorrow. Or ever. Caldwell's car entered the Taggart Fort a few minutes after he left Sutherland. The four outside walls held the offices and barracks. The inner court served as the assembly ground and parking lot for vehicles. He was met and asked to report to CID. "Are you going back to Jerusalem tonight, Major Caldwell?" the Criminal Investigation Division inspector asked. Freddy looked at his watch. "Yes, I plan to. We can make it back before evening if I leave right now." "Good. I have a Jew here I want taken back to CID in Jerusalem for questioning. Maccabee prisoner. Dangerous one. There is a chance that the Maccabees know we are holding him here and will be watching for a convoy to transfer him. That is why it will be safer if he goes in your car. Happy to do it. Bring the Jew boy in." Two soldiers dragged in a boy of 14 or 15 years of age, manacled with heavy chains on hands and feet. A taped gag was over his mouth. His face was bruised from a CID third degree. The inspector walked up to the prisoner. "Don't let Ben Solomon's angel face fool you. He's a ruddy little bastard.